I'm fathering.
This is Dave.
And this is Tex Trek.
Engage.
Episode of the Tex Trek podcast, and we are talking about the third episode of Star Trek Discovery. Context is for Kings.
So we started with 20. That was our first Discovery.
Well,
no, that's right. That's right.
We combined the first two.
Combo, yep.
As they combined their story into one narrative.
Oh, wow.
But
so amazed.
This is what has been called the second pilot of the show.
Right. We're
introduced to a new batch of characters, a new setting. And, Dave, you didn't have the warmest of feelings of the show last week. How do you feel now?
Do you want to find out if it warmed my cockles? I notably like this episode better. I'm still wrapping my head around its approach, which feels, honestly, more in keeping with something like Battlestar Galactica, or, for the handful of people who watched it, Stargate Universe. It was kind of a Battlestar Galactica riff itself. I don't know, what was that else that I mentioned earlier?
Babylon 5 came up.
Yeah, a little bit of Babylon 5 and its sort of darker turns. It's interesting to be watching a crew that's, like, so clearly kind of like a Black Ops, Dirty Tricks-ish kind of off-the-grid ship. But it was something that we talked about as a possibility, so it's not completely unexpected. But the very quick version is, I felt that the crew gelled a lot better, that the having an episode where there was more time to kind of see the characters sitting around and talking to each other a little bit, getting to know each other, and they weren't immediately, like, in a wartime situation. I decidedly liked it better. I felt like the characters' interactions and sparks that I wanted to see were there. Seeing Lorca and Burnham together, Lorca and, was it Tip? Tilly? Is
yeah.
that her
Cadet Tilly.
Cadet Tilly, yeah. Did I say Lorca and Tilly? I meant Burnham and Tilly. And Burnham and Stamets. All provided, like, some really interesting scenes that to me were more interesting than the almost any of the interactions in the first two episodes.
Hmm. Yeah, my favorite part of the interactions in the first two episodes, which I like them more than you did, but my favorite part was after I started reading Desperate Hours.
Right.
And then went and rewatched those.
We probably should say what Desperate Hours is, even though we've talked about it a little bit, just a reminder.
Yeah, that's the Star Trek Discovery tie-in novel by David Mack, available now.
Right. It hit, like, was it within a day or two of the debut of Discovery?
Within 2 days, yeah.
Yeah. It did, I'm just a little ways into it, and I do feel like it's offering insight into the characters that's actually really handy. It did, especially in relation to Burnham and Saru early on, but also Captain Georgiou. The three of them are definitely kind of front and center in it, and there's some keen insights into them, I guess I would say. But we're going to talk about that more in a separate podcast.
We'll discuss it during the mid-season break between episodes 8 and 9. But as for tonight's topic, context is for kings. Dave, what was tonight's story? How would you summarize that?
Let's see. Sure. We begin with was it 6 months have passed?
Mm-hmm.
What's it, Commander Burnham, or now with no rank, I guess. Has been in prison in that time, and she's being transferred somewhere. And she's
doing,
like,
hard labor.
She's doing, like, hard labor. She looks dead to the world. Like, and in fact, throughout a lot of the episode, she has a haunted look, like somebody with, like, serious PTSD, like serious traumatic effects. But she is sort of manipulated, we will later find, by Captain Lorca to get him on board his ship. He's definitely an unorthodox thinker who's either coerced or manipulated or won over a crew of kind of unusual people, of whom Burnham is clearly being vetted to join. And the mission of the episode is to explore a disaster of sorts that happened with their sister ship, said to be more advanced than them, the USS Glenn, mm-hmm. I think. There's some action and drama there. There's a creature loose. This creature has torn the shit out of some Klingons. In the meantime, in the episode, Burnham interacts with all the crew members kind of icily or with some coolness, but it gives us insights into her, insights into all the Discovery crew members. And we also, there's a big, big mystery that's being revealed, but isn't by any means wholly revealed, about the nature of the Discovery and what it's doing, and all those predictions we had about what the hell is the deal with the fungus.
The
expert.
Fungus ship.
Yes.
The fungus-powered engine.
Yeah.
That sounded crazy when I first suspected that, but...
Well, when you mentioned it, I knew that, like, it wasn't going to... They weren't going to describe it in those words. They were going to try and find a way to make it, technobabble to present it more coherently. And they did. They haven't given away everything, but they did tell us that, you know, it is not, in fact, a weapon, as Burnham surmised, that they're not building a bioweapon. But it's... And I was not completely clear on exactly how this works, but... They likened it to like a strain, like strands of fungus or spores.
Mycelium?
Yeah, like spores spread throughout the entire like known universe.
Yeah, there's a spore network connecting the whole, holding the universe together.
And exactly how they are traveling down that, how their own studies into the fungus allow them to kind of access this spore-like structure that underlies the universe, I didn't quite understand. But it is clear that they are using it to blink from one place to the next, like, with astonishing speeds.
Yeah, so instead of warp speed, where you put a warp bubble around your ship that allows it to go faster than the speed of light, this is more like an instantaneous
more wormhole
jump.
Kind of concept.
Yeah.
But even more so, where wormholes, like, traditionally, at least as Star Trek does them, it's like, oh, they're few and far between, so when one shows up, it's like you can catch a train to a few different places, and it's always going to be handy and faster than walking there. But this is as if the train went everywhere. Any given, you could say, I need to be in Washington, D.C. tomorrow, and I need to be there in like a minute, and there's a train that'll get you there in a minute.
Yeah, there's different pathways through the mycelium network mm-hmm. that's holding the fabrics of space together.
Now, I don't know if it's actually mycelium or that's what they're carrying that's... He said it was analogous to that.
Yeah, we were kind of unclear on what Lieutenant Stamets' explanation was. But I think it's something that they might explain more later on. And I feel that way about a lot of the stuff in the show, a lot of the more mysterious elements, a lot of the things that might not seem to make a lot of sense now will be explained. And you see this in modern TV a lot, that they try to set up weird mysteries right off the bat.
Sure.
And unfortunately, sometimes the shows don't have the big payoff that you want, but
right.
The thing that they have kind of figured out the science of, that modern writers have kind of figured out, is how to set those things up.
Right.
And hopefully Discovery will deliver on them.
I think it's
the
series that have the longest running mysteries that often stumble. Depending on who you talk to, X-Files for sure would be a big example of a sort of a stumble, and it had a very long run.
Still haven't watched that last season.
Was pioneering the arc format, so, you know, cut them some slack. Mm-hmm. More recently, Lost for sure had I enjoyed Lost, but like I see the criticisms, and I could see people saying, yeah, they didn't pull it, they didn't stick the landing. But shows that are shorter format, I think, have a better opportunity to pull it off. I never got around to watching What was that HBO show with Woody Harrelson and...
True Detective?
True Detective.
Never watched that either.
I understand it to be, like, a really intense... The first season to be really intense and good. But even there, I remember, like, my brother told me, like, he didn't think it kind of stuck the landing. And I think that only ran, like, 8 or 10 episodes. So, it's a risk. They could still fumble it. But they do seem to have... There's a sort of a sense of confidence about the show and the way it's revealing the mysteries. And I do feel like they probably... have a sense of where they're headed with it. What was your first take on it? What's your hot take?
Well, there were a lot of things I liked, and first and foremost was probably actually seeing the Discovery and meeting the characters who we know will be the principal characters throughout the show.
Yeah, I guess I should have made a bigger point of fact that we actually saw the effing Discovery.
Yeah, and we also actually saw the captain who's going to be...
Saw lots
probably
of...
Probably the main guy running the ship this first year, at least.
Potentially an antagonist as well. It's kind of hard to tell exactly where they're headed. It is interesting to not quite know on that. Like, he has villainous qualities, but he also had this, like, keen character insight into Burnham and other people. And I can't tell if they, you know, might want to be doing a little bit of a suggestion... kind of like what's his name in A Few Good Men. I think we probably brought up this notion before. Jack Nicholson's character,
yeah,
the guy who is like, you know, his vision of himself is you might hate me and I might be a monster, but you need me to.
But
be
I
that
get
monster.
Shit done,
right? And certainly, I would say that's probably how, at least how Lorca sees himself.
That's what it looks like. I thought that was weird when they have the first introduction of him to Burnham and. He says he can't turn the lights on real fast because it'll hurt his eyes.
Right.
That was weird. He had an eye injury that I'm sure we'll eventually hear the story about that. And he said that he has to slowly dial up the light so that it doesn't hurt his eyes too much.
On a symbolic level, the notion of someone who has to
stay in the dark
is certainly matches up with his character.
I loved how he, you know, there's like this trick where that writers use sometimes, where if you're writing something that's that might come off as a little silly, if you just point it out to the audience,
right,
it makes it okay,
right?
And he points out that you know, I think this makes me sound mysterious, and he
right, he kind of it sort of. Pokes a little bit of fun at himself. It's like he's like, aren't I creepy? A little bit. I found him to be a charismatic kind of person.
Yeah, because he ate fortune cookies and tried to like hand them away. I wanted to see Michael Burnham open the fortune cookie and see what her fortune would
be. What if
it
was just lottery numbers? You know, it would have been awesome if he had just, like, when she walked out of the room, if he had just eaten the tribble right next to him.
Oh, yeah, he also had a tribble on his desk, which I can assume might be something that was maybe a Denobulan doctor in his old years, Dr. Phlox, who also used weird creatures for medicinal purposes. He prescribed a tribble to this
to deal with
veteran
PTSD.
Who'd seen all kinds of war and had all these demons, and he gave him a nice, soft, cuddly tribble that would coo gently and keep him calm.
You know what that means? There's some episode where he's not going to eat the thing, but he's going to kill it in a moment of anger.
Oh.
And you're going to be like, oh man,
that's
there
dark.
Is no turning back. It's like kicking a dog or something like that. This character is forever the ultimate bastard of the universe. I'm going to go ahead and guess that something like that happens. But I also thought it might have just been there as a little bit of visual humor. It's an interesting contrast to his darkness. And because we know that they're essentially kind of off the books, he's able to do like battlefield commissions and says...
Yeah, this guy has a lot of clout with Starfleet.
Yeah, that they are leaving him alone to do unorthodox tactics. This guy, even though historically... By Kirk's era, like 8 or 10 years later, they don't have a lot of awareness of tribbles. It's not the craziest thing in the world that this guy might.
Yeah, well, we saw Phlox have a tribble on an episode in Enterprise. And it's funny, I was watching this with my girlfriend recently when we were watching Star Trek. And you know, she had never seen the episode before, so when Phlox is walking around in sick bay, and he pulls out a tribble, and he's showing it to Hoshi.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend was like, oh no, this is going to be another tribble episode. They're going to take over the ship. And he's explaining to Hoshi how they have, like, this remarkable property that allows them to reproduce at an extreme rate. And then he feeds it to one of his other creatures that he keeps on in sick bay.
Oh, man. You know? Yeah, that's right.
And I told her, like, nope, that ain't going to happen on this ship.
But that's amazing.
How did you, by the way, feel?
Just out of curiosity, how did you feel about Burnham? How do you feel about her state of mind and all this? Like, and like as a protagonist, you know, a lot of times you get like characters that are, oh, he's too brash a hero, or he's a little damaged, but there's this inner good side in him. She was like particularly damaged for a lead protagonist. What did you feel about it?
I like this approach. The first episode or first two episodes, they set her up to be an extremely capable person,
mm-hmm.
and you always have the fear of creating a Mary Sue type character. Like,
right.
I was talking to you earlier today about how they kind of did that with Kirk, where he was the, and I love Captain Kirk. I think he's great, but he does have that, he's awesome at everything.
And in many ways, all of the Trek captains embody some stripe of that. I mean, they are all supposed to be larger-than-life heroes. Borderline what I would think of as, like, superhero level, like Captain America or somebody like that.
Although, I kind of preferred what they did with Janeway, where they made her, like, she was just the former science officer, and mm-hmm. so all of her, you know, expertise really came in with science stuff.
Right.
But, yeah, a lot of the captains, like, they do seem like they're just great at anything. They're a master of whatever skill they need to be a master of to win the day. And I think by making her be such a damaged, defeated character right off the bat, you can cancel out any fear of her coming off as like completely infallible.
She is. I mean, do you think she's Do you think she's unlikable?
No, I don't think she's unlikable. I like her.
I like her, but she is unlikable. I think.
Yeah.
She's completely like cold to Ensign Tilly. Like when she first comes in. To be fair, Tilly seems like a handful.
Or Cadet Tilly.
Cadet Tilly.
She's
yeah,
not an
yeah,
officer
you're right.
Yet,
you're right.
But
Cadet Tilly. She's a handful, clearly. She's a little bit... we talked about this earlier. My sense, and I am by the farthest thing from an expert on this, so I might be stepping outside my territory, but my sense is that she felt like she was like almost on the autism spectrum. She definitely was not great with the social cues. She was kind of... immediately, like, not picking up at all like that Burnham was like kind of this cold person and she was like super bubbly at first. I liked seeing it though. It kind of felt real in a way. It reminded me at least a little bit of Barclay.
Yeah, that's what we were calling her, kind of a young female version of Barclay.
Yeah. Not his like precise particular thing. Like she didn't seem, he seemed to lack confidence. She seems somewhat confident.
Yeah.
I think she had some issues.
Well, she's convinced that she's going to make captain someday.
Right, right. Yeah, she has like, but she definitely relates to people oddly. And I don't know, I kind of liked her. She was in some ways for me the first, I thought, sort of overtly likable character. Although I imagine there's some people out there who are like...
You didn't like Captain Georgiou?
I kind of didn't. I don't know why. It's hard for me to pin down.
Hmm.
Maybe because she felt like a traditional Trek captain, and because everything else about the show is so non-traditional, she felt out of place or something.
I liked that, though, because I think if I didn't see the traditional Starfleet type characters, it would be hard for me to believe this world is in Star Trek.
Right, right. Yeah, it does feel... We're in very different territory. They're doing a lot of things to subvert traditional Trek.
Yes.
You know, she gets it is a unique ship, and she gets kind of a cold welcome from a lot of different people. Stamets, who I also liked, was very cold to her.
Yeah.
Do
you want to talk about Stamets?
Yeah, sure.
We talked about Lorca, we talked about Burnham, we talked about Tilly. So, I was so happy to see Lieutenant Stamets, and Anthony Rapp, the actor, he's such an extremely nice guy.
Right.
Who's been so, great with fans on social media and has been really cheerleading for this show. And he's been also rewatching all of the past Star Trek shows. Yeah. A lot of them he's seen for the first time and just, like, commenting about, yeah, I watched this episode of DS9, it was so great, and talking to fans about all that stuff.
So he's really engaging with
you. Yeah, and I wanted to see him on screen. Mm-hmm. And his character is an asshole.
And
he's not a guy I would want to work for or work with. But
right, well, you know, you say that, but he's also... He's one of the more principled characters we've seen on it. He has clearly been...
there's layers to these characters.
Essentially, yeah, there's layers.
That's not like, you know, Chekhov is the wide-eyed, can-do-it attitude Russian kid on the bridge. There's a little bit more nuance and layers to these guys.
Yeah, he's clearly essentially been blackmailed into service. Ed hates Lorca. Isn't shy about saying it because he was talking about it in front of, what's the name of the security chief?
Landry.
Landry.
More on her in a minute.
Right, right. I'm going to go ahead and throw out a prediction related to her, and I think you know where I'm
going. Let's talk about Stamets, then we can move on to her.
Yep. What else to say about him? I mean, I'm sort of blanking suddenly on like this.
You're saying that he will be honest about how much he dislikes Captain Lorca, and he hates that his whole science
experiment...
He's a scientist.
He's not a military.
Yeah, it's been hijacked by Starfleet, even though, like, he believes in Starfleet's mission of diplomacy and exploration, and he wanted to use his science in more of that type of positive direction, but instead it's being used to fight this war.
Yeah.
And he's resentful to Burnham for starting this war.
Right, right. Yeah, he did not immediately... I don't know if I've seen him with anybody who's like a friend per se.
Well, he did have
a colleague he talked to, and there was a little bit of kind of interesting like verbal interplay that sounded like antagonistic, but was really more like a friendly antagonism.
Yeah.
That I thought was kind of cool.
They said that they had worked together for years,
right.
And they were split up by Starfleet, put on different ships to try to hopefully speed up the. Experiments that they're working on with this weird fungus engine.
He got kind of snippy with the guy, and it was kind of cute.
Yeah, well, some people are. I'm kind of like that with the people that are like super close to me. That are like my dearest friends. I'm probably more snippy to them than I would be to. But he's snippy to everyone though. He's snippy to strangers.
So the character is gay. The do you think he? I felt like he had a little bit of. Hey, I'm going to... at the risk of stepping on a landmine here, he had a little bit of the particular gay snippiness to it.
Yeah. Well, he's played by a gay actor, so yeah. I don't think he was, like, intentionally dialing up his gayness.
Right, no. And I don't think it was, like... I actually thought they did a really good job of not... It was by no means, like, I think what people will say is, like, the main thing or the first thing, even, that they remember about the character. I thought it was actually... But it was nice, though, that it might have, like...
We just talked about him for 5 minutes, and it just now came up.
So. Yeah, it just kind of, like... Yeah, it was, like... It was maybe a little bit in the background. I think some people wouldn't even necessarily have picked up on it at all.
Yeah, because they don't even say that he's gay. We just know that because we've been paying attention to the casting.
It's in the bio and stuff behind the scenes. I kind of liked his... I liked his brand of snippiness. I will be very curious to see how he ends up as, like, an ally or not to Burnham. I don't know what direction she's going to go in, because it did seem like Lorca had kind of psychologically profiled her in a pretty sharp way, saw her need for redemption and to get out of the life that, you know, of waste that would have happened to her in a prison, that is, like, the very thing that, like, Sarek had, like... You know, warned her against. Speaking of Sarek, Saru also has gone through a change in the 6 months since we've seen him.
So let's talk about him. He is now finally first officer.
Yeah.
Which we know from Desperate Hours. This isn't a spoiler because it's established in the second chapter of the book. That was a important career goal for him, was to move up in the ranks and be a first officer.
And he had some decided resistance to Burnham, she was fast-tracked, basically. She leapfrogged over him, and she hadn't gone through Starfleet Academy. They did, I mean, that's sort of, I don't know if we had known that to be confirmed.
No, they haven't said that in the show yet. But yeah, she was given a commission after she graduated from the Vulcan Science Academy.
Right. So, and he sort of seemed to, like, treat it with a mixture of, like, resentment and also some self-loathing, I think.
Yeah, but she was kind of a jerk to him, it sounded like. And we see that in the first episode where she's kind of teasing him about being scared of everything. And, you know, why don't you just finish your scans and give me some facts instead of giving me your fears?
I seem to remember, I think in the book, I think she mentions that it's almost like she kind of can't resist doing it. Like, it's a slight compulsion to kind of screw with them.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a sibling rivalry or a sibling bickery.
And here it looks like he, on some level, he ultimately expresses in the episode he wants to, he regrets that she's, you know, that a good a person as smart and talented as her has thrown away their life. And does sort of want something good to happen to her, but he also can't seem to forgive her.
Yeah, because he still fears her. Like, because that's his whole thing is fear.
Yeah.
He is a...
he's probably right,
a cowardly alien.
I would feel the same way. You know, they definitely made a point. They used the word mutineer a lot. They need to bust out that stormtrooper, the traitor! because that is how everybody reacted to her throughout the whole episode. But he's not wrong to say that she's kind of dangerously unpredictable. It seems like, as smart as she is, if she decides something, if it goes against the general, you know, Federation plan or what the crew's thinking, she might act on it in a dangerous way.
Well, if you go back to those first two episodes, the Klingons didn't really start the war because of her.
Right.
You know, it was... maybe they saw that she had locked weapons on, and that tipped the scales to make them actually fire. But yeah, Takuvma had his plan all along. He, you know, destroyed that relay. He was trying to lure a Starfleet ship out there, some of the other Klingon houses, and start some shit. You know, that was his objective. And one of the things that kind of bothered me about those episodes was I thought maybe they should have had her go far enough to actually shoot off a couple of torpedoes. And, and, you know, so you have, like, a clear action that character committed to start the war.
But I kind of wanted that to happen just to embody the notion of the title, The Vulcan Hello.
but I think the reason why she blames herself so much is because when she killed Takuvma instead of capturing him out of rage of losing her captain... I think that's why she is hating herself so much. And I love that Captain Lorca was able to look at this stuff and kind of have the same feelings that I have and be like, yeah, it's actually not your fault that you started the... it actually made sense for you to try to get your captain to open fire first.
Right.
You know, you're the type of person I want to have around. I agree with everything that you did.
Yeah.
And I want you on my team.
Right. The question is, does he... I mean, I think he... do you think he means it? I think he probably does mean it.
Yeah, he seems like a guy who would respect...
but he's also so manipulative that he also might know just the right things to say to get her on board.
That's true, and...
I don't think that's the case, but it is interesting that these characters are cagey enough that there's two very distinctly different motivations he could have had in a scene, and it's not necessarily obvious. Trek usually wears its heart on its sleeve, and its themes on its sleeve. So this is... it's not just subversive in the sense of showing kind of people who are far less squeaky clean than the average Star Trek, but it's actually the storytelling is more nuanced too, and subverts traditional Trek storytelling tropes.
And then, anything else about Saru?
I don't think I have anything particular to say about
him. You see his threat Gangala come out of his head again.
Yep. I was trying to tell what had triggered it. It was like the prisoners, who, by the way, more hardened prisoners than you usually see on Star Trek.
Oh, these prisoners were fucking scum. I was surprised that they were...
Some Galactica prisoners.
I was surprised that they were such scummy humans still around in the 23rd century. They're talking about, like, murdering Andorians, which could have just been talking shit, but...
my notion is this, that if you've got some bad eggs in a fairly utopian future, they gotta be pretty bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm sure there's still pockets of poverty and all sorts of other things, all the things that normally put somebody in the situation where they become desperate enough to do that. So, you know, these guys seem to have enjoyed the life.
I would have loved to have seen a Nausicaan or some other nasty alien in that prison ship.
They definitely they've amped up the general background alien quotient, not necessarily explaining who the aliens are, but... there's definitely more of them, notably sort of more, I would say, like, facial like cyborg implants and things like that.
Yeah,
some of which look like they could be cosmetic. Some of which seem like they're there for a reason. For instance, was it the helmsman?
Yeah, Kayla, who was the helmsman on the Shinjo, yep. has received some type of cybernetic enhancement on the side of her face that is maybe...
Looks like due to injuries, probably.
Yeah, maybe healing an injury, or maybe that's like the equivalent of, what do you call it when you give someone a prosthetic?
Right. Yeah, it could be something like, yes, you have a permanent cranial tear, and, you know, it is so bad that if this is not here all the time for the rest of your life, you know, even with our cool medical technology, they couldn't fix Geordi's eyes in the in Next Generation.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm guessing she also kind of gave Burnham a look that was like traitor. She was definitely not feeling.
Yeah,
her
she
presence.
Did not want to have lunch next to her on the mess hall.
No.
I think the other character we need to talk about who came up earlier, that would be Landry, the female security officer on board the Discovery, who. Lorca seems to be doing some shady shit, and she seems to be the character backing him.
Right, she is his right hand man, so to speak, and
she's the Mercy Graves to Lex Luthor.
Right, we were trying to figure out if they have a romantic relationship. Did we determine from that line? He says something like,
"We'll spend some time together tonight."
Yeah,
but I think he was talking about the creature that she brought on board.
Right, I think you're right too. But I'll be curious to see if that's definitely spelled out or anything.
We don't learn much about her. We kind of just the way that the character
she was eyeballing Stamets when he was on his like kind of rant about Lorca.
Yeah, a lot of her behavior. And she doesn't have that much dialogue, but just a lot of her physical behavior. It tells us that she is, all business, no bullshit, and...
we know that, we literally saw that she's doing some shady behind-the-scenes stuff for Lorca, reporting directly to him, so there's definitely that full-on, I'm your right-hand man kind of vibe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that she isn't some sort of, this is a ridiculous theory, but that she is either a covert agent for either the Federation to... do the nastiest stuff he requests, but be ready to put him in check if he ever threatens the Federation. I mean, that's one guess. Or I do think it's conceivable that she could also be a Romulan or Klingon agent or something like that. But I'm going to go with Federation.
Or
Federation double agent.
She could just be obviously really loyal to Lorca.
Yeah. all possibilities. With Occam's Razor says that is probably the answer. But I just want to put
the other ones are more interesting.
The other
than
ones
that.
Are... And, it's not as if they don't have enough pieces in motion. So I don't know if I'd say that it's more interesting because they've got more stuff going on. But it's more interesting for her, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, I want to get the accolades in the off chance that this long shot bet pays off.
And we see her as the chief of security, and she has some security personnel. But there's also... some people on the ship with black shields that...
Right.
We know in the Star Trek Discovery time period, the Starfleet color codes are gold for command, silver for science, and bronze for operations.
Huh.
Medical is white. So no one knows what a black shield would represent.
Right. Was it only among the guards?
Yeah.
Could it be as simple as like special ops?
Yeah, but it was secretive because it sounded like it was a surprise to the convict who noted on that. You know, he sounded like he knew.
He wanted to know what special ops.
Yeah, but he sounded like he knew what Starfleet.
Oh, yeah.
Insignias would.
I mean, I guess
color codes would represent.
The obvious surmise is, oh my gosh, is this the secretive?
Section 31.
Section 31. But it would be super weird. At least I think it'd be super weird for them to be wearing basically a Section 31 badge.
Yeah.
It goes against everything that they stand for.
Yeah, this shouldn't be like Star
unless
Trek.
Unless they're rethinking them.
This shouldn't be like Star Trek Into Darkness, where Admiral Marcus just, in his office, just tells Kirk and Spock about Section 31 one day.
Right, right.
Which kind of makes sense, because he was sending them on a suicide mission to die.
Right.
Starting a war with the Klingons.
Right. What's, what's telling a secret to a dead man?
Anyways, back to Star Trek Discovery.
I think the most important thing that we haven't addressed yet is that Burnham says at some point, shit.
Oh, yeah.
which for a Star Trek TV show is a first.
Yes, we've heard shit before in a couple of the movies,
yeah,
but never on a Star Trek TV show episode. And let's talk about the build up to that. That was when they go to investigate the other ship, the USS Glenn,
right?
Where this ship had been making the space jumps with their fungus engine, which has been working a lot more efficiently than the Discovery's. The Discovery can only jump about 100 kilometers, they said, and the Glenn is jumping 90 light years at a time.
Right. Lorca, by the way, I mean, he seemed very cool and passive when they destroy the ship at the end. He was like, it's just a ship. I mean, first of all, he completely bypassed mentioning the crew at all. That's messed up. But that ship was like some, like, felt like very advanced. I wonder if they might have missed a beat by having him say regret, show, express some regret just that the technological advancement it had over them was lost. Or maybe he thinks they can make up for it pretty easily.
Yeah, maybe he was jealous of that ship, and so he's glad that the competition is gone.
I can absolutely see
it. He did say that was contention between Lorca and Stamets, is that Stamets hasn't gotten the ship to work as well as his colleague on the Glenn.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, just a quick mention, this colleague brought up the Z Manny's Prize. Which
is it, Manny's or Magny's?
Or something like that.
Yeah.
I had to Google it. I actually didn't remember that off the top of my head.
Some kind of scientific prize in Star Trek universe?
Daystrom from The Ultimate Computer.
Richard Daystrom?
The original series had won that. And also Ira Graves from the Next Generation episode, The Schizoid Man, had won that award. Schizoid Man.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Whatever. What does that mean, anyways?
I think a schizoid break would be like a multiple personality split.
Yeah, like schizophrenia?
Yeah, something like that.
That's supposed to be just like a stand-in for the Nobel Peace Prize, would sound more futuristic.
It's a space Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, that's what someone was thinking in the 60s.
Right.
So
that sounds good.
But their ship, the Glenn, it gets into some trouble. They go over to investigate.
And to some degree, we never fully find out exactly what happened other than clearly something related to their research went bad.
Yes.
But also, like, Klingons did get on board.
But they,
we
they
think
said,
the Klingons came after the fact,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, because when the away team that goes, they bring Burnham with Saru's recommendation that she's the smartest officer he's ever known. Right. They get on board. It's her, Tilly, Landry, Stamets,
and
a red shirt, and they encounter a ship full of balled up, ripped open, twisted corpses.
Right. It's like if you got
which we've
like,
never seen anything like that on Star Trek before either.
It was gory and pretty horrific. The only thing it reminded me of was that weird transporter accident in Star Trek The Motion Picture, where it's clear people are getting weirdly fused and bent up on each other and stuff like that. But
which
yeah, these people look
the most
like
horrific moment in Star Trek history. Actually,
it's that or the SETI eels in Star Trek II. But yeah, it was weirdly horrific for Trek, and this was as well. These people literally look like they got like physics like black hole morphed and crushed around themselves.
Yeah, and that poor Klingon that was wandering around in the corridors. Yeah. He was walking around like how you would see. In Saving Private Ryan,
somebody on the beach in
Normandy. Soldiers like walking around on the beach, not knowing where they are, what's going on. They're so traumatized.
Yeah, which makes sense because we saw piles of dead Klingons elsewhere.
Yeah, but he was killed by a big tardigrade thing.
It's clear that we're not supposed to know what it was. For a minute, I thought because of the presence of the Klingons, it might be a Targ.
Yeah,
until we actually also see Krug's pet in Star Trek III. But yes, it's much bigger. Clearly not a rethink of that. It would be not be going after the Klingons if it was just that. It looks like some kind of weird, accidentally grown alien. But, like, we don't even know that for sure. Right?
Yeah, we don't know if that's something that came from the ship. We don't. What I thought was a possibility was that when they were doing these space jumps, it's kind of doing an Event Horizon thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't seen the movie Event Horizon, it is about a spaceship that does a similar type of space jump technology, but it passes through I guess, hell or somewhere where you're not supposed to go, and it brought back some evil shit.
Right.
That movie also had Jason Isaacs in it.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
So,
wherever he goes.
Yeah, that evil follows. I thought it could have been like some... in Star Trek, you would explain it as like, oh, it's a creature that lives in...
warp space or something like that.
Subspace. Yeah. They brought it back, and it was... it acted bad.
It would, it would make sense if this was meant to be a reflection of a tardigrade, since we know they can live in space. Mm-hmm. So if they had this like kind of bigger, nastier version of them that can somehow live in subspace or something.
But when you see one of those coming at you, that's when you say, "Oh shit!" in Star Trek,
right? Or later on, quote Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, and I'm thinking we might hear more on that. But I was glad that we got Amanda mentioned.
Right, that is to say Amanda Grayson,
Mother of Spock.
Right, Sarek's wife, who apparently read Alice in Wonderland to Michael when she was younger. Yeah.
And so I'm thinking with her reciting that, I'm thinking that that was something she probably learned as a human on Vulcan, trying to learn how to deal with her emotions. She probably
She felt like a stranger in a strange land, not unlike Alice.
Yeah, maybe like she would recite literature that she'd memorize to help her cope with her emotions.
Right, it was interesting, it was like a litany. You know, it was like a going through a Catholic litany or something like that. Mm-hmm. She saves the day. Let's just real quick talk about.
Yes.
There's that action scene, and then there's also the action scene where she takes out some prisoners with some Vulcan ninja moves.
Yeah, she has Vulcan martial arts, which we know that T'Pol knew on Enterprise, which they used one time. I was like, oh, this is a really cool idea. You're giving T'Pol something neat to do. You're making her less like Spock and more like her own thing. And then, like, they never really used it except for one episode.
It's a weird ball to drop. Especially since that show was running in the 90s?
In the 2000s.
2000s?
Or the zeros.
Still running, in the wake of the Tomb Raider badass chicks era.
Yeah, and also it seemed like it'd be an obvious thing.
Yeah. It seemed like it would have been an obvious thing. Well, Burnham clearly knows how to fight.
And we also see Burnham doing some...
She whooped up on three dudes.
Yeah, and we see her do that. We see her save everyone from the tardigrade and get back on the shuttlecraft.
Yep.
And we also see her doing some sneaking around on the ship when she used her roommate, Cadet Tilly's drool, to trick the breath machine.
Yeah, I'm a little weird about their space breathalyzers. That just seems a little odd for Trek.
Yeah, but like, it seems like different.
It was something different.
So
it seems like it'd be
something different.
A little easier.
They did something with it.
To fool that. I mean, it's clearly, I guess anything can be fooled, but what if it had been like a thumbprint ID, as simple as that?
But
was she going to have to chop off Tilly's hand?
No, we've seen people use like tape on someone's thumb,
right?
Like, stuff like that.
Yeah, but they have super cool sensors in Star Trek's future. Except apparently not that cool because it can't recognize that a person didn't breathe out the DNA matter or whatever. But it was like sponged.
And I love that Lorca knew that it happened because he calls her out on it later when they have their conversation where he's explaining more about the fungus engine. But yeah, I like Burnham. I think they're doing some really cool stuff with her, and I think this sums it up real well. Was in the second episode in The Battle of the Binary Stars, when she does the Kirk computer ninja trickery to fool the computer, or convince the computer to let her out of the brig.
Yep.
That was very TOS Kirk.
Yep.
Then when she has to float through the hole in the force field and float across space and get into the corridor, that was very Kelvin verse Kelvin movie J.J. Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
So she can do both types of Kirk.
Right.
And
doing that stuff was, I mean, it also, like, that particular thing was a little bit more of a Spock twist on it, because she had to poke around at the logic and make it, figure out the computer's version of logic, and then beat it.
Yeah, and she has, like, that Spock or Data type of, super intelligence.
Yeah.
And the smartest officer that Saru has ever met.
It's interesting to have a character who drops both the logic bombs, but is also prone, at least in the first few episodes, to emotional outbursts and kind of interactions.
But she needs that weakness to not be like the infallible Mary Sue type.
Right, yeah, I don't mean it as a criticism. I think it's part of what makes her interesting.
Yeah, I think it all marries together very well.
I think part of the reason why I would say she's unlikable kind of comes down to, would I want to have, like, lunch with her? And I'm like, well, I've seen her kind of be a jerk.
I don't want to have lunch with Stamets, but I like to watch the character.
I'd have lunch with Stamets. I think he'd be all right.
He'd make fun of you. He'd be like, are you so stupid to think physics and biology are two different things?
Yeah, that's true. He was very condescending. I mean, I guess it's going to have to come down to really lunch with Tilly. the first.
I would go have lunch with
likable character in the mix.
Although she might be a little annoying.
She clearly, like I said, yeah, comes with a little bit of baggage. But it is. She seems friendly in her way.
So let's just talk about that. Towards the end of the episode, the final scenes, we do get a little bit more explanation with the fungus engine, with Lorca showing it off to Burnham, how this could also be used as an instrument of exploration.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of makes it more acceptable to be in Star Trek.
Right.
You know, this is something that Starfleet
it's just that, like,
was working on for a more benign purpose.
Right. Do we think he believes that?
I think he does.
Well, I mean,
does.
He probably believes it is possible, but do you think he cares about that?
I don't know. I don't know enough about him yet, but I could see him being a guy who he cares about the...
Right, he'd be like...
The Federation
nice.
And Starfleet exploring, but he feels like he needs... I need to go win these wars so that they
right.
can do that nice stuff.
Right, yeah. I think he might be a guy who's like, it's not within me to do that, but somebody could do it one day, and I'm going to be the guy who lets him, who enables
yeah.
him to do it.
Do you feel like you kind of understand now why Jason Isaacs said Lorca is probably the most fucked up captain?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree
I
with
mean,
him.
Here was a guy... The last shot of the was it the last shot of the episode or was it just one? No, it was near the end of the episode
yeah.
when you see him with his menagerie of beasts,
his chamber of horrors.
Yeah, it's like Dr. Moreau stuff. Yeah,
it looked like he had a Gorn skeleton.
Right.
I saw a Cardassian vole, the six-legged Cardassian rat that has like the spoon-head forehead.
Yeah,
the Cardassians.
I think those are the only ones we feel pretty confident.
Yeah,
about.
Well, I think I saw a face hugger from Alien, but.
They're
doing that tie-in comic with the Captain Picard versus the Xenomorphs.
Oh, are they?
Is it going to have
right.
Data and Bishop together?
Oh, that'd be interesting. That sounds pretty good. I like to think that I saw the shell of the mother,
the city eel mother.
Thing,
that, yeah,
but
Khan
I think that
pulls
one's
the young ones out
yeah,
of.
I think that one's a sort of dodgy guess, but I'm going to throw it.
It was like on top of a stool,
like a little platform.
Yeah,
thing.
Kind of further in the background, in that shot.
If you can identify some more ones, there was some other stuff in the background, like on like some shelving yeah. unit or something that I could was a little too small to see. So if you've got some guesses, some alternate guesses, let us know for sure.
And we learned that Landry has beamed the tardigrade monster.
Yeah,
I'm going to stop calling it the tardigrade, but
that's
the
as good a name as any. You know, tardigrades are also called
the
saber-toothed
water bears, tardigrade.
And I don't think you're going to want to call it a water bear.
Yeah, but. Doesn't sound as scary as the creature looks.
And it was pretty creepy.
Yeah, but Landry
do we think
that aboard for him. So
right.
we don't know why he wants it or what he's doing with these creatures, but
is it just that it's one more thing to research?
Maybe he's trying to convert the fungus engine into a biological weapon. Maybe he's seeing how...
So Burnham was, like, more right than she thought.
Maybe he's like, I need a bunch of different types of creatures and see how I can use this to, like, destabilize their cellular structure that holds these life forms together or something
right.
like that.
I think, Father, you said that you'd already seen somebody online who was saying, oh, well, if they can use this fungus technology to get around the universe like that... it's a completely odd screw-up of continuity because why aren't they doing it in every single Star Trek
yeah.
afterwards?
Yeah, this obviously is not going to work. Spoiler alert, this stuff won't work.
Yeah, or it will work.
Or someone destroys it.
It'll
yeah,
work.
Because it's being used so nefariously that another character is like, no, like we don't need to have this technology. I'm destroying all Lieutenant Stamets' work. Maybe
right.
Lieutenant Stamets himself will destroy it all. He's like, yeah, there were two scientists in the universe that knew this, and the other one's dead, so I'm going to blow all this stuff up.
Or maybe the detente that occurs between Klingons and humans comes when Burnham reaches out to them and says, I need a Klingon commando force to go in and blow this guy's base up. Just a
possible.
Thought.
Yeah, that's how they come to peace.
Yep.
That would be kind of a Star Trek-y thing to break bread with your enemies and work together collaboratively.
Yeah, who's the guy, who's the albino guy, Vok?
Vok.
Yeah.
We didn't see any of the Klingons, Lorel or Vok or Cole or anyone they set up
before. Or Sarek. For that matter.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, so this was very much about the characters on the Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
That was, well, I guess we had some prisoners, but other than that, literally only people we saw were the Discovery officers
mm-hmm.
and Cadet Tilly, who I guess isn't an officer. But so yeah, this was this had more character in it. That was attractive about this episode.
I'm not necessarily
you're not sold on it yet.
I'm not sold on it yet because it is so different from Trek, and like I guess. You know, you can sort of speak derisively, or I would say maybe what's the word? derisively of Trek as, like, traditionally Trek is a little bit pat. The problems are solved in an hour-long episode. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of part of the ethos of Trek.
They haven't solved shit yet.
They haven't solved shit. But I do like, as comfort food, as kind of like nerdy comfort food, if that's what Trek kind of has been to some degree, that's what I like. I'm like, oh, I love it. For sure, that's not what this show is going to be. Now, if it's not going to be that, I need it to be good at what it does. I felt like it was only okay in the first two episodes and wasn't reeling me in. Like, I can, just as a minor example, like, I don't, like, love watching horrible people in movies, like, that are, like, really terrible people. But I can, like, Goodfellas is a tremendously watchable movie.
It's funny, I was actually thinking that, but
it's an easy example because, like, the characters are also watchable and interesting. Yeah.
Well, you like Seinfeld, and I think all those people are jerks. I don't like any of them.
Right. Well, I mean, they embraced that. That was the whole premise of it. Yeah. They knowingly did that. So, if I find somebody compelling and interesting, then I will potentially cross any.
So you're seeing potential now.
Yeah. Notably more. At the same time, I feel like weirdly stymied a little bit because I'm like, man. There was humor in this episode. There was definitely some humor with Tilly and some other little dark bits.
And I needed
dark bits of humor, like the Klingon, that poor bastard. Yeah. it's a serious show, and they are doing bad things, and I don't know what everybody's motivation is, and I feel like I'm in Galactica territory, and realizing that even if this kind of reaches out to Trek territory, the journey is not going to be a Trek-like traditional journey.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to decide if I want to take that journey with them. But right now, for sure, it's interesting enough, and it doesn't feel not Trek, but it kind of feels not Trek.
Oh. Any final thoughts on the episode?
Just real quick, Discovery itself. I just wanted to, like, ship, we got our first good look at it.
Yeah, I'm liking the design now that I'm seeing it in action. You know, I had kind of warmed to it before. I never hated it. The more I look at it, the more it has grown on me. And I liked that opening shot where you see it with the tractor beam.
Yep.
You know, they kind of reused the tractor beam savior moment from what they had just done with the Europa.
As long as Burnham doesn't get saved by a bunch more tractor beams and it becomes the Death Star, Starkiller base cliche.
Every Star Wars movie needs a Death Star now. Yeah. Every Star Trek episode needs a
tractor beam save.
Last minute save.
Although we will note, we've been wondering about the pilot of the prison ship, shuttle.
Did she die? Did the Discovery beam her on board? Yeah. Or?
And if Lorca was manipulating a lot of those events, did he kill her? Did he just let her fly off? She couldn't have been more than like 50 feet from him. It was a little bit weird to not just kind of address it. Just a bit of visual continuity, because at that point we didn't like know she was dead. In fact, those energy mites or whatever that were on the outside weren't said to be lethal and like physically lethal, or at least not.
No, they just hurt electricity or equipment that runs off of a power source.
I did like the. I do think the ship looks very cool. It is weird because McQuarrie's design sort of speaks to certain 70s sensibilities and also to Trek when they hadn't sort of codified the visual design so much.
For sure,
but. Because they are deliberately subverting Trek a little bit, it kind of makes sense to go with the design.
It's supposed to be a weird experimental ship. It's designed to handle 300 different scientific missions at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's going to have.
Have they actually said its crew complement yet?
No. That's what I thought that person was saying. I thought they were going to be like, yeah, it can have 300 crew on board.
But... which kind of would have fit. I'm like, okay, yeah that's.
But it is like the right size. It's about the same size as Kirk's Enterprise.
Is it?
It's maybe a little longer, but it doesn't have as many decks.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my take on it, just based on what the scale looks like from the windows and from the shuttlecraft going in the back. I love that they didn't do what the JJ movies did, where they made all the ships so much fucking bigger and they're just too huge.
Yeah.
A lot of those designs I like. I actually like the shape of the Kelvin, mm-hmm. but it's way too fucking big.
Yeah, it is. They definitely ran with the bigger is better kind of notion. I think there was, I don't know if there was like size envy versus because like Abrams is a Star Trek or Star Wars guy.
Yep.
And he was like, oh, the Star Destroyers, man, they're crazy huge. Although, you know, the Millennium Falcon is smaller than the Enterprise, right?
Yeah.
It's like notably smaller. Anyway.
What about the shuttlecraft, though? We saw some new shuttlecraft designs that...
Oh, yeah, they were kind of a little bit more long and lean.
Yeah, the aerodynamic.
I'd have to see more of them to really... To pin it down, but they look cool. You know, yeah. I thought they looked good.
But other than that, we didn't really see... Well, we saw the Glenn, but it's the same class as the... We still don't know what class that is. We know the Shinjo was a Walker class. I don't think we know what class the Discovery and the Glenn are.
Interesting. So. Yeah, that's true. That's a kind of surprisingly notable thing that maybe hasn't come out yet.
Yeah.
Overall, I definitely liked it more than the early episodes, and feel more excited about the show as a dramatic television show. The Trekkie in me is what has to be won over. That's where I'm at.
But yeah. To be fair, when Next Generation started, you had a different idea of what Trek was, and sure. You felt that show betrayed what you thought Star Trek should be. So.
It's true.
Maybe the secret is that we have to expand our definitions of Star Trek. Yeah. It has to be an ever expanding definition.
I need to expand Star Trek's hopeful message to include murderous dog handlers and fungus that crushes people into balls.
Yeah,
and corpse bombs. You know, I love the corpse bombs.
I'm okay with the corpse bomb, but.
Even in the Geneva Convention now, not allowed people. Just saying, Federation, you think would be at least Geneva Convention compliant. All right.
But
we talked about it previously.
That's in the past. We're going forward to next week's episode, which is titled... What's the title of next week's episode?
Shit.
Oh, it's the coolest title. It is The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry.
Oh, yeah.
Which, with what we know about this show now after this episode, I'm fucking terrified to see what's going
to... Yeah, is this the animal experimentation episode?
This is going to get into, like, some Hannibal Lecter-type territory next week.
It could be. Wait, yeah, Fuller produced Hannibal, right?
Yeah. So in this episode, felt like it had that dark Hannibal, Brian Fuller influence.
I would certainly say one of the show's qualities is its unpredictability, and the fact that I'm a little bit nervous about things. Like, I don't know quite where... You know,
that's,
I guess,
kind of exciting, though.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's a sort of nervous excitement.
But, yeah, we'll be talking about that next week. I'll also be doing Easter eggs and thoughts and trying to explain any discrepancies for this episode and another video I'll be posting. I just posted one for the Vulcan Hello, and I'll try to get one of the... battle at the binary stars up as soon as possible.
And get no prize from Stamets.
Yeah. So keep your eyes out for that. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you want to check out our audio only podcast, they're going to be available as always at techstrek.com. And until next time,
live long and prosper, y'all.
Thank all of you so much for checking out this installment of Tech Trek. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to like our YouTube videos and subscribe to our channel. Audio-only version of episodes are available at our website, www.tex-trek.com. Please check out our site, especially if you just want an audio-only podcast. We have that available for you. Y'all can also keep up with us online. You can follow us on Twitter, @TXTrek. Or you can check us out on Facebook at www.facebook.com/tex-trek. Please, by all means, let us know what you think by dropping a comment anywhere you see fit. We definitely want to hear your feedback. Let us know what you liked and what you would like to see more of, what you would like to see differently going forward. If you want to email me directly, go ahead. I can be reached at fatheryactual@tex-trek.com. Thank all y'all again. Take care.